Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
And good afternoon. T-minus less than 2 weeks. 2 weeks from today, we will be pulling out. Probably already be at C, in fact. Let's see, 601, yeah. Well, we should probably be at C, probably leave about 5. The day after the debate. And so that means, wow, we are in debate mode. Let me tell you that much. We are very focused. Most of what I'm thinking about these days is textual variants and chorus versus karate at Hebrews 2:9 and all the rest of the stuff. In fact, right after the program's over, they're going to have to give me time because I just realized I can't do the program in here. I'm going to have to go into the other room to do the program with apologetics.com. Sort of a pregame show is how they want it to work for the Bart Ehrman debate. So we're going to be talking about Bart Ehrman's claims and how we can understand them and respond to them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that'll be right after the program. If those guys are listening, then you need to give me a second because I fired up Skype and then I realized, wait a minute, this isn't my Mac. So that ain't going to do me any good, actually. And so I'm going to go ahead and sign out of that thing. Except me need to make sure I'm potted down here because this thing makes noises when I do that. So today on the program we're going to continue listening to Bart Ehrman with the Infidel Guy. Those of you who are wondering, I do not have any responses from Tim Staples. I sent the email in. I don't have his personal email anymore. I've had a number of different emails, but I'm assuming that since he went to Catholic Answers, those are defunct. We have not corresponded personally in a number of years. And so I didn't get any response. So who knows? What can I say? I tried, but what? Sure, that's fine. Let me just secretly hear. I haven't a clue. This is how really super high level professional broadcast people communicate with each other. Now, Rush just simply says people's names and talks to them, and then goes but we don't want to just look like, you know, we're imitating someone like that or anything like that. But I'm just trying to decide right now whether I'm going to jump into the topic for the day, but I'm waiting for someone to finish typing a letter to me. In fact, it looks like it's going to be a book, a very lengthy book. I think we'll go ahead and clear the board first and then get into our topic, which is not on the same subject, but we'll take a shot at it anyways. Let's talk to Joe. Hi, Joe.
Yes, sir. Can you hear me, Dr. White?
Yes, I can.
Dr. White, number one, I love you. I am an awesome fan. You're an awesome man. I'm a fan of yours. And I just wanted to talk to you a few seconds about Calvinism. I am going to go, Lord willing, onto Dr. Michael Brown's show tonight because he's got In the Line of Fire. I'm sure you know Dr. Michael Brown, correct?
Yeah, I moderated the debate between himself and a Jewish rabbi, Rabbi Shochet, at Arizona State University in 1995.
Wonderful. To further along the debate of Calvinism, because I am a student in seminary, not a doctor, and for some reason I'm not getting a lot of respect in this genre, I'm wondering, he hasn't answered me, I'm just going on the show with him like I'm going on with you, kind of putting it out there. If I can get him to dialogue with you about the subject of Calvinism, would you be up for it?
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, at this particular point in time, with the debate in 2 weeks, and then the Sola Fide conference right after that, and I'm hoping to have, I'd hope to have an announcement even today, maybe on the blog tomorrow or at least next week, about a major debate in April that will be a first. If it's useful to people, great. I mean, there's not too many arguments on that particular subject we haven't gone over before. And I know that Dr. Brown, if we're thinking of the same person, I'm assuming that you're referring to the gentleman who's a converted Jew and is an expert in Old Testament material and was involved with the Brownsville Revival a number of years ago.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah, I know that he's would not be considered reformed, and so we would have, I think, an interesting conversation. So, sure, but in this particular area, what has to, from my perspective, what needs to be there is that the people of God are going to be edified by it. That there's going to be something that is meaningful to be, to be presented. Generally, when I try to play like the John 3:16 stuff. There's a reason why I'm doing that. These are common accusations. These are people who are in leadership positions. I don't know that Dr. Brown has written anything on the subject, has he?
Not that I'm aware of either, but I've never heard you debate. I've listened to, I think, all of your debates with non-Calvinists. I've never really seen you encounter someone that is as qualified as him. I don't think that David Hunt or the guy from Calvary Chapel or the last guy you did a radio debate with for 3 days is anywhere on your level of learning and understanding or on Dr. Brown. So I was wondering, have you ever discussed the subject publicly with somebody with a doctorate expert in languages as well? Like yourself, like you're Greek, he's Hebrew, Have you ever gone to that extent,
Well, see, the main reason that I would have to say no, not really. I mean, obviously, Norman Geisler would go there, but he doesn't want to. Most of those who defend that kind of a perspective either are not into doing that kind of debate or dialogue. They'll say that they won't debate Christians or things like that. That's what Norman Geisler says. Or the majority of those who would literally identify themselves as Arminians, they actually recognize what their own theological perspective is and wouldn't try to come up with a name like a moderate Calvinist or something. They really hold their position for philosophical reasons, not for biblical reasons. And so one of the reasons there isn't a whole lot of discussion there is because there's not a whole lot of common ground because many of them have very low views of Scripture, unfortunately. And so certainly the debates on open theism and inclusivism with Dr. Sanders, he calls himself an Arminian. So we certainly haven't shirked those who have expertise in those areas, but I think people saw at that point that there's just a real fundamental difference in the view of Scripture that exists between the two sides at that point. So, if Dr. Brown would be interested in especially doing something exegetical, that would be fine, sure.
I appreciate that because just to further this a few more moments, I know you want to get to Bart Ehrman, and I can't wait for that debate with you and him. But just to kind of go on that, that's really where I feel it's missing. For example, like with your YouTube account, I responded to you with a couple small videos, got maybe a few hundred hits. I'm going to do a little minor debate, so I'm kind of working up the minor leagues, maybe up to you one day. Maybe you can let me come on a show. I'm in seminary at AGTS, Assembly of God, Theological Seminary. And what I think's kind of missing is the people that are challenging you are not qualified. Now, like you said, they probably maybe don't want to. The ones that are qualified don't want to, and that's kind of frustrating for me. Like a Norman Geisler doesn't, but he could. And then my professors don't, they're not into it. And so I don't think, it's giving the right perspective when you're, it's not your fault, but we don't think the way these guys think. Like, I'm not David Hunt. I'm not a Calvary Chapel guy. I was listening to your response to William Lane Craig and him trying to be politically correct with atheists. See, we're not like that. When I say we, like an assembly of God, spirit-filled Pentecostal believer, brother, we are 100% with the judgment, the condemnation of God upon sinners, the wrath of God. Jonathan Edwards is probably most Pentecostals' heroes. You know, we look up to him, John Wesley and Whitfield, you know, all the way back down to the church fathers, et cetera, like Augustine, we would all find good in him. But I just don't see you know, dialoguing with them. And he's an expert also in church history. You know, and I just don't feel anybody bringing these people up. I've never heard anybody debate you, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, who's even brought up, you know, the fathers, the patristic fathers, as the quote.
No, actually, Steve Gregg is big into trying to argue from church history, which I, of course, you know, from my perspective, it's like, well, that doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, if Paul had to deal with people who were removing the sovereignty of God's grace and salvation during the apostolic period, I'm hardly shocked whatsoever that people, especially, do not even have the full canon of the New Testament in the apostolic period or something like that would be far more influenced by Greek philosophy than they are by the New Testament. But as far as dealing with the exegetical material, dealing with the New Testament text, we have certainly offered all sorts of people with doctorates the opportunity of engaging the subject. You know, the canners, we know what happened with that, and they've just all turned those things down. Dave Hunt turned those things down. So, you know, if something were to come up, that'd be fine. But you know, it's I'm not running around trying to find every non-reformed person and force them into a debate. So. You know, when they write on the subject or they're addressing the subject, they have a certain audience, okay. But if, you know, I know that that he obviously has a certain following, and that would be useful along those lines.
Thank you. I know you have to get going. Can I ask two quick questions? One more, I'm sorry. Justin, Martyr, Clement of Alexander, you're saying those guys weren't informed fathers? They wouldn't be somebody you would...
Well, there's two are very, very different. Justin Martyr... shows very little knowledge of Paul, is far more influenced by Plato than he is by the New Testament, and Clement of Alexandria is so far off on the left-hand side of things. I mean, very same stream as Origen in Alexandrian theology, and I would not look to either one of them as overly helpful sources, especially in the area of soteriology at all, no.
Okay, and then number two, how come on your YouTube account you don't put up comments? Because I'm getting thrilled by Calvinists, and I'm sure a lot of non-Calvinists would like to comment on your YouTube pages. How come you don't allow us to comment and people to put responding videos on this?
Because I'm not into the construction of internet ignorance aggregators, which is what a comm box is. 99.98% of all comments are idiotic. And they are. They are from people who have absolutely no earthly idea what in the world they're talking about. So... half the time atheists use them to post profanity and things like that. There's just no reason to do it. So I make myself available for 2 hours toll-free, and so far not a single one of those folks has had the guts to pick up a phone and face me directly. So why in the world should I give them free, you know, they can, every one of them can start their own account if they want, and you know, so anyways, all righty.
Can I just say one more, brother? Do you love me, even though I'm not a Calvinist? And if I confess Christ, am I still your brother? Because you are an awesome man of God,
yeah,
brother.
Yes,
that's all
you're,
I gotta
yes,
say.
You're still my brother. I would love to, you know, discuss some of the issues that would separate us, but that's not the point. So,
okay.
We
thank
appreciate
you. Sir,
you. All right, time. Thank you. God bless.
God bless. Thank you.
That always worries me, folks. Just real briefly, that normally means we're going to be 15 minutes into the program by the time we get done. That's how it works. All right. Anyway, you know, I've never seen, actually, the video, or because I know it was videotaped. I've even heard the audio of the debate between Michael Brown and Rabbi Shochet. I remember his name was Shochet. I moderated that at Arizona State University in 1995, and I've actually mentioned it a few times because I wrote on my notepad, as I listened to Shochet speaking, the Pharisees live. The Pharisees live. That I mean, it was like I was listening to the very people quoted in the gospel accounts 2,000 years later, it was fascinating. Anyway, let's press on. I began on the last program to play the audio of an encounter between the infidel guy, what's his name, Reggie Finley, is that what it is? Anyway, and Bart Ehrman. And what we've heard so far is the infidel guy who wants to believe whatever Ehrman has to say as long as it's post-Christianity. We've been hearing, the things that Ehrman says. But hopefully we'll get far enough today to find out that all of a sudden they started having disagreements. So let's continue listening.
Okay. I'm trying to think of an argument around that, because I'm trying to think, well, they could say, well, yeah, but we still have the word today, so obviously the word was preserved in some way, but I guess that fails because we still have these multitudinous copies.
Well, the problem is some of this, you know, as we'll probably go into more depth in a little bit, I mean, there are thousands and thousands of differences in these manuscripts, and most of these differences don't matter for anything. I mean,
okay.
They're absolutely unimportant. But there are some changes, some differences that really do matter. They affect how you interpret an entire passage of the Bible.
Now, one of the questions that may come up in our encounter in 2 weeks would be, Dr. Ehrman, why do you always emphasize how many textual variants there are when you then follow up that, well, of course, the vast majority of them don't mean anything, but you never really give the proportions. You never really tell people what we're talking about here. And when you actually go through this, and I'm going to have to present the most packed 30-minute opening statement ever known to man to get to all of this, but when you actually go through the kinds of variants in the New Testament, movable news and spelling variations and word order variations, and you divide them out into the nonsense irrelevant type, the meaningful type that impact the meaning, and then divide the meaningful type into those that are viable, that is, there's sufficient manuscript evidence to substantiate them, that they have some chance of being original, and those that are non-viable, there isn't enough. When you actually break it down that way, we're talking about less than 1% of the New Testament text. And when you... He just loves just to say, well, there's 400,000 variants. That's almost three variants per word in the New Testament. That gives to the students the impression that there's three different ways of reading every single word in the New Testament, and that's not true. I will be putting up some graphics of entire texts of the New Testament where there simply isn't any meaningful variation in the manuscripts. But that's not what people would hear when they listen to Bart Ehrman. Now, he remains technically correct, but it's the context in which you put technically correct statements. Haven't we all learned enough from listening to politicians today to know that you can, say factual things, but it's the context you place them in that makes all the difference? That's one of the biggest problems I have. And clearly, the infidel guy has no clue about the subject of the background of the text in the New Testament. He has no idea what the manuscripts actually read, the nature of variation. He wants to believe the worst possible case scenario. And as long as what Ehrman says is good enough for that, then he'll
accept. Or even an entire book of the Bible, depending on which words you think were the original words.
This is one of Bart's big things, is look, there are places where the entire meaning of a book of the Bible depends on which manuscripts you read. And I'm going to be asking, give me an example. And if he goes to Hebrews 2, I'm going to be ready. If he goes to Mark 1, I'm going to be ready. I know every example he's used in his writings. I've read all of it now. I've got all this stuff. I've got it sitting here right next to me. All you need to have is misquoting Jesus, the orthodox corruption of Scripture, and his Brill compilation of scholarly articles. They all repeat the same stuff, sometimes word for word, over and over and over and over and over again. It's the same stuff. It's not a wide-ranging amount of material. And I can't think of a single place where the theology of an entire book of Scripture is dependent upon one of the textual variants that he cites. I can't. And I know a couple that he suggested, and I find the argument to be just extremely contradictory, and we'll be getting into that in the debate.
And that depends on which manuscript you want to trust.
Right.
And so it actually matters a lot what the differences in these manuscripts are. So it's not really right to say that we have you know, that we basically have the word. Well, yeah, we do have the word, but it depends which manuscripts you read, which word
right.
you have.
That's a very good point. I remember when I first stumbled upon, I mean, for most scholars, this is a moot issue here, but I remember when I first stumbled upon unicorns being mentioned in the Bible. And, of course, people, you know, scholars can't come up and then say things like, oh, well, you know, they're still trying to debate what animal that really might be. It might be a wild oxen or a rhinoceros. It's just ream. Is okay, but why is a unicorn then in the 1611 King James version of the Bible? That immediately...
Now, at this point, Ehrman would have to try to explain to this gentleman what in the world is going on here, the difference between manuscripts and translations, and try to help this very ignorant man out. But is he going to do that? Let's listen.
You would think should raise some eyebrows, and people should want to look deeper and say, well, wait a minute, what does this word really mean, and does this change the whole meaning of some of these things? And that's what I kept finding out, that the more I dug, and the more I began to realize that people were changing things, somebody was. And the topic of the show, like, who is doing this stuff? Who was trying to hide the contradictions? Who is trying to make it make more sense and more relevant to our modern society? Obviously, I think in doing this, Bard, I think they're kind of conceding that maybe the Bible as it was isn't relevant to today. That's why they have to change it so much. What do you think?
Well, you know, there are lots of reasons for...
What? Did any of that make any sense whatsoever? I cannot discern the slightest bit of logical argumentation with what was just said, and I don't think Ehrman can either. So what you do in a situation like that is you sort of try to find something that was said and run with it, in essence.
Scribes changing the words they copied. Most of the changes actually were just made by accident. I mean, they were because...
Now notice, he's not addressing what the guy just said. He's just moved back to what he's there to talk about. And whether the infidel guy has any clue as to where he's gone, why he's gone there, or what he's saying, doesn't... really
copying something and they'd be sleepy or they wouldn't be paying attention and they'd leave out a word or they would misspell a word or they would do something just an accident. But there were places where scribes copying the text, I mean, it looks like they intentionally changed what they were writing.
Inspired by God, of course, though, to change them.
yeah, I mean, some people have argued, of course, that the King James Version itself is the inspired version.
Mm.
But that means that most people throughout history haven't had the inspired version.
Well, that may be true, but that's not what he was just talking about. I mean, talk about perpetuating category errors. How many people are totally confused about the difference between translations and the transmission of the text of the Bible? The vast majority of people are, unless you listen to this program once in a while. We talk about things like that. But for a lot of folks, they're going to be going, oh, so like the King James is a manuscript and... And how you translate the King James has something to do with scribes and scribes changing things and wow.
I mean, it's nice that, you know, you have it with the King James, but then what about everybody else?
Right.
So, but I think most people can see, I mean, most intelligent evangelical Christians don't think, you know, that one particular version is the inspired version. They think that the inspired version was the original version. And that's the reason for trying to figure out what the original was, so you can see what the original words were.
Right. And of course, we have no such thing. So address this issue for me. We all too often hear the term the Bible. How do you view that? That's not entirely correct, is it? It's not just one book we're talking about.
Well, in fact, when you were earlier describing your understanding of what the message was, I don't think that there's one message in the Bible.
Okay.
I think there are lots of different authors who have lots of different points of view, and it's important to let each author say what he wants to say rather than assume that, for example, the Gospel of Mark has the same point of view as the Gospel of John. Well, those were written by two different people who didn't know each other, and if you read each one carefully, in fact, it looks like they have a very different perspective. And so I think it's very important to know what each different author had to say.
And in fact, I believe you brought that up in your presentation, that it's pretty obvious to people who studied the writing styles that in reading some of the scriptures, you can tell when another author has added something because the writing style completely changes, and sometimes the writer's thoughts is just, or the direction that the book is going, like for instance, for a position, all of a sudden you'll see this addition, and all of a sudden the author is like against it or something. You can tell someone is...
It's hard to...
Now, wait a minute. Now, just wait 1 minute. Is this gentleman actually suggesting that he has the capacity to engage the text on the level of being able to detect stylistic differences? I know there are people who make these arguments, and these arguments are very, very often extremely unreliable, let's put it that way. Just this last Sunday at the church, I was going over the authorship of the pastoral epistles, defending Pauline authorship, and pointed out the type of arguments that are used, that even Ehrman uses, against the pastorals, and how you can take those arguments and turn them upside down and argue against Romans being Pauline. Anybody who basically is determining things on the basis of statistics, and, look at these word groupings here. That type of stuff is just not overly reliable. It may have some interest, may have some validity here, there, everywhere, but it is generally an unreliable. But that normally requires you to actually be reading it in the original language, and I don't get the feeling that the infidel guy reads Greek. So for him, I was just reading along, just my unbiased, morally neutral self, and I detected a change in authorship here. Oh, come on.
Yeah. It's really hard to show that with people who are just reading it in the English.
But yeah.
Right. If you read the text in the original Greek or in the original Hebrew, there are, within a single book, there'll be different writing styles. I mean, it's kind of like if somebody took a book by Mark Twain,
mm-hmm.
and inserted a couple pages that T.S. Eliot had written,
right.
It'd be pretty obvious that it was a different author, and you get that kind of thing where it looks like pretty clearly that there are different authors for some of these passages in the Bible.
Hmm. But again, of course, they'll apologists for simply say that, God inspired that person to put that in there. And they just and it just goes all over.
Yeah, that's what apologists say. Right. When you hear folks presenting what apologists say, and I don't know of a single apologist in the world that said that, it reflects just a bit on where that person's coming
on and on and on and on. Now, one of your critics, Lee Strobel, and I've written this down here, he said that basically misquoting Jesus is overblown, one-sided, and terribly misleading. He said that none of your...
I would agree with that. I think if you will listen to the warden of the Tyndale House at Cambridge on Justin Brierley's unbelievable radio program with Bart Ehrman from January 3rd, which is available at premierradio.org.uk, I think. I'm doing this totally off the top of my head, but just Google Justin Brierley and the Unbelievable Radio Program, and you can get it there. He basically said the same thing. It is very rare that Dr. Ehrman is wrong with his facts. It is what he does with them. It is the rhetoric. It is the spin. It is the context. It is the length to which he goes and the imbalance of the treatment of the facts. And if you want someone who's quite scholarly to say that, then you can listen to that debate, and you'll hear exactly that.
Textual problems affect any major doctrines of Christianity at all. What do you think?
I never claimed that they do, so
okay.
I'm not really sure what he's objecting to.
Mm. Okay.
Now, catch that. He wasn't expecting that. Because Ehrman plays this game where he on the one side, in the debate in London, the radio debate in London last week, he'll say, I don't really think that any major Christian doctrine is determined by a particular textual variant, but there are textual variants that are relevant to major Christian doctrines. Well, that's true. There's no question about that. If there's a textual variant that impacts whether, in Acts 20:28, whether God or Lord is used in Acts 20:28, that's relevant as to whether it will be relevant to that particular doctrine. No kidding. But what if you just listen to his presentations, where he doesn't have anyone, there to hold him in check, where he's not talking to other biblical scholars, that part doesn't come through. And it's amazing to me. All you got to do, it's found in all of his books, every single one of his books, articles. He's going to do it here. One of his favorite things to say, they are relevant to doctrines, because the only explicit statement concerning the Trinity in the Bible is 1 John 5:7. And the first time I heard him mention the comma Johannium, as if this was somehow relevant, this is somehow a revelation to people, that the comma Johannium, 1 John 5:7, is not a part of the Greek manuscript tradition. Shocking. Really? Is that so? Amazing. I had no idea. No, this is such basic stuff. And it amazes me that he would actually make the argument that there is, you know, some type of you know, importance to the Kami Yohannium, as if Christians have always depended upon the Kami Yohannium to defend the doctrine of the Trinity. No, we haven't. I wrote an entire book on the doctrine of the Trinity. And I never had to defend the doctrine of the Trinity on the basis of the Kami Yohannium. It's very frustrating on that level to listen to this kind of stuff.
And he says,
I should say, there are some passages that are pretty important. I mean,
right.
There's only one passage in the entire Bible that explicitly teaches the doctrine of the Trinity.
Okay.
In other words, that God is made up of three persons and those three are one.
Right.
That verse is found in the King James Bible in 1 John chapter 5 verses 7 and 8. But as scholars have known for centuries, that verse actually wasn't in the original text of the New Testament. It was added much centuries later. By people who believed in the Trinity. So I'm not saying that the Bible, you know, denies the Trinity. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, what I am saying is that the only verse that explicitly affirms it wasn't originally there.
Now, again, how does Bart Ehrman know who, quote-unquote, added it? How does he know where it came from? The vast majority of scholars I know think that it was a gloss, an interpretation of the text in 1 John that was written in the column of a manuscript. So when he says it was added in there, here's perpetuating this idea that there's, you know, these people who can control the text of the Bible. No, it's found in Latin manuscripts. And eventually it comes into the late, late, late Greek manuscript tradition, probably after the time of Erasmus, after the time of the invention of printing, through the Latin. But what does it mean to say it was added? And then to hear the interview, I'm sorry, but I mean, this is Bible 101. This is as basic as it gets as far as talking about textual critical issues. Just amazing.
That's important.
That seems important. I mean,
yeah.
So I'm not sure what he means. I mean,
right.
So yeah, that seems important to me. I don't know.
Wow. But let's talk more about these older manuscripts, because I found that something very, very engaging when I watched the video, because you kept talking about these comparisons that a lot of people don't know, but we actually do have access to some of the older versions of what we read today, and that they are way different in many cases. Some very, very close, but many are way different.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, that's the kind of information I point out in my book on misquoting Jesus. And
now, way different. What is Dr. Ehrman not able to detect where this guy is coming from, and what he would think way different means? What does way different mean? Does way different mean the difference between the right hand side of the manuscript spectrum, the most Byzantine of the Byzantine manuscripts, and say the left-hand side? I'm not sure exactly how to define that, because I would actually see Alexandria more in the middle and Western. You know, there's a mixture of things here. But let's go ahead and pick on the Alexandrians just for the day. The most left-hand side, the you know, P60, P75, or Vatican, or something like that, what does the infidel guy think? He thinks that in the Alexandrian manuscripts, you have one Jesus and one gospel and one teaching. He's a little bit like a King James guy, King James only guy at that point. And then the Byzantine manuscript, you have a completely different Jesus, completely different stories, complete difference between the two. And that's not what Ehrman's saying in any way, shape, or form. Read his book. And if you know the field well enough, then you will be able to see what Ehrman is saying. But the point is, most people don't know it well enough. And so they misinterpret what he's saying and blow it way out of proportion. And he just doesn't try hard enough to keep that from happening.
It's what makes me kind of wonder when someone like Lee Strobel objects. I mean, I haven't heard anybody object to any of the facts that I point out in the book.
Right.
Which strikes me as a rather odd way to attack a book by agreeing with all the facts.
But And why is that? Because I've said over and over again, Dr. Ehrman tries to be very careful about what the facts are. But if I say to you, as he says over and over again, there are 400,000 variants in the New Testament, more variants than there are words in the New Testament, and I go on from there, and I don't say, however, 99% of them are irrelevant, and we need to differentiate between variants that are meaningful and viable, and that are meaningful but not viable, and so on, or just all the variants that are not viable, and we need to talk about movable news and how the majority of the differences are movable news, which is the difference between A and an in English. And we need to talk about the fact we're talking about 5,700 manuscripts, 1.2 million pages of text. And so this number of meaningful variants over 1.2 million pages of text is very, very small. And then you need to explain that now, you know, we're talking about 400,000 variants, that's over 5,700 manuscripts. But since his own methodology pretty much dismisses almost all the minuscules as being overly relevant, he really doesn't have much to say about any manuscript past the 10th century. That cuts down the number of manuscripts massively, and it would cut the variants down to maybe 50,000 instead of 400,000. But he doesn't say any of that. He knows it. And if I've got enough time and the Lord works a miracle to where the cross-examination period just goes very, very slowly, I can ask these things and get that brought out, but it's not in the book. I doubt that it gets said in the class, and that's why I really, really hope that you're praying about the debate coming up, that we'll be able to get those questions answered and answered clearly.
One of the facts is that we have old manuscripts now that weren't available, for example, to the King James Bible translators. And we have manuscripts that are centuries older than what they had, and these manuscripts are quite different in some ways from the manuscripts available to them.
But quite different in what ways, Dr. Ehrman? In what ways? They're different in the sense that the Byzantine manuscript tradition tends to have more conflations, expansions of terms of piety, but they're actually teaching the same thing. In fact, Dr. Ehrman, if I took the most Byzantine manuscript, most Alexandrian manuscript, if I take the same manuscript that Erasmus depended on for the creation of the Textus Receptus, of the half dozen that he had, which was from around the 12th century, if I take that manuscript and I take Codex Vaticanus, and I apply the exact same standards of exegesis and hermeneutics to the two, am I going to come up with a different God and a different Christian message? And there's only one answer to that question. No. No. But that wouldn't go over well with the infidel guy, as we're going to see.
Reminds me of, let's talk about the book of Mark, for instance. This is considered one of the oldest books in the Synoptic Gospels, correct?
Yeah.
And I know you mentioned a little bit about this in your video, or in your presentation, but I'm thinking right away that if this miscopying is occurring over and over again, then Mark and Luke are probably a product, and in some instances some of John too, are just more miscopying and some embellishment probably by some of these scribes.
What? And it must be what Ehrman's thinking. What? I mean, I can't even begin to make sense of this. He doesn't understand the difference between the autograph and scribal copying over time and what's happening in the writing of Matthew. He's just throwing stuff out here just because, well, he's the infidel guy.
But because those books come later, it kind of makes sense. It follows that that's probably what's happening there as well. What do you think about that?
One of the interesting bits of studying the New Testament is trying to understand the relationship of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the three Gospels. They're called the Synoptic Gospels. And in some ways, Luke is a copyist of Mark because Luke was writing later, and he apparently had Mark as one of his sources available to him.
Right.
And there are places where he changes what Mark has to say.
Right.
And sometimes those changes are quite significant. And so one way that people study the Gospel of Luke is by seeing how he's changed Mark, because if you see how he's changed what Mark had to say, then you get an idea of what Luke was trying to emphasize.
Right.
The scribes were doing something kind of similar. They also were copying the text and changing it in places.
So there's a massive difference between scribal activity and theories about literary dependence between the Synoptic Gospels. Now, I every time I hear Ehrman just simply, you know, just throw out the, well, you know, Matthew and Mark are sitting there, and Matthew and Luke are sitting there, and they've got Mark, and Matthew goes, ah, I just don't like the way Mark said this, I'm going to change it. Wait a minute. In all of Ehrman's presentations, he never takes into consideration, he always has the writers as individuals. They're never in a community. Never in a community. There are never any eyewitnesses. There's nobody ever moves around. It's just one person and his ideas. That's his phone game thing, you know, where, well, one person tells another person about Jesus, that person converts, they go someplace else, tell somebody about Jesus, and it's just this one line of transmission, oral stories getting changed over time idea. There's never any idea that these people ever got together. Even though the most primitive documents show the Christian community as the ones possessing these teachings, as the eyewitnesses in the Christian community. So if Luke does have Mark, and Luke does say he's using other sources, and he's dug into these things, and he's studied these things, and other people have written up compilations, so on and so forth. But if Luke is just sitting there with Mark, doesn't Luke know that Mark's work is already a part of the community? And that people know what it says? And so if Luke is changing things in Mark, doesn't Luke know that other people are going to see that too? There's this really deep modern arrogance in a lot of modern scholarship, to where you just think the people who lived back then were just really dumb. They just could not think like we can think. Because we've got computers and gadgets and stuff like that, we are just so much brighter than any of them ever could be. And so Luke isn't smart enough to figure out that, you know, if I completely contradict Mark, someone might recognize that. And so maybe that should enter into our thinking somewhere along the lines. But certainly not entering the thinking of the infidel guy here, because that's not what he's even looking for. He's just looking for anything he can use as ammunition.
It's intriguing that, so basically you end up, I guess now we have to go back to the early formation of these books. From what I've been told, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but many of the New Testament books, these Synoptic Gospels, came from various cities. They came from different places. And then they just were later put together later. And the titles of the Gospel according to yada, yada, yada were added.
That's right. I mean, whoever wrote the Gospel according to Mark didn't call it the Gospel according to Mark.
Right.
Whoever called it the Gospel according to Mark is telling you who, in his opinion, wrote the Gospel.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, you know, while that is repeated over and over again, there is something that we might want to point out. We've never found a manuscript of these books that doesn't have that that description. And so it's a theory that says, well, before any of the manuscripts we had, they didn't have these. But we've never found any physical evidence of that. I think that probably needs to be kept in mind.
But, you know, I mean, you know, when I wrote Misquoting Jesus, I didn't say Misquoting Jesus according to Bart Ehrman. I mean, that wasn't the title.
right.
So someone else might tell you that this is a book by Bart Ehrman, but it's not what I would put in the title. And that's the same with the Gospels. Hmm. These are added later. You know, we don't know actually who wrote these books. They probably were written in different cities.
Mm-hmm.
They probably were not written by any of the 12 disciples of Jesus, because
right. The
12 disciples all spoke Aramaic and were uneducated peasants from Galilee.
Yeah, there we go with the. I mean, if you're a peasant from Galilee, you were just dumber than a rock. You wouldn't know anything about Greek. You couldn't possibly even use a scribe or an amanuensis to write anything. And so all you knew is Aramaic. So when that Roman soldier started yelling at you in Greek, you didn't know what to do. So he just ran you through, and so none of them ever lived. Oh, never mind that. it's just thrown out there just so simplistically so often. I'm sorry, folks, but I've been listening to stuff for months now. And after a while, you just start going, oh, man, enough already. Let's get to this debate. My goodness.
And these books were written outside of Palestine by Greek-speaking Christians who were highly educated.
Your critics are going to say, how do you know that they're uneducated?
Well, because the New Testament says so. I mean,
now listen.
Acts chapter 4, verse 12, for example, says that Peter and John, the two of the closest disciples, were illiterate, literally what the Greek says. They were
unlearned. And since they're standing before the Sanhedrin, it's far more likely that what is being referred to there is that they had not received rabbinic training. So how could these men who had no rabbinic training do this type of thing? You just can't allow for any other way than the Ehrman way of understanding these.
They're agrammatoi. They didn't know letters. So, the New Testament itself says that the chief apostle, Peter, was illiterate and that John was. And the others probably were, too. There have been studies.
I'm sure Matthew was. Yeah, those tax collectors, they didn't ever have to write anything.
Kind of literacy in the ancient world. The most important one was by a guy named William Harris, who teaches at Columbia University, who showed that, in fact, the vast majority of people in antiquity couldn't read or write.
Right.
The only people who could read or write were the upper class elite who had a lot of money and time to get an education, and that certainly was not the fishermen of Galilee.
Notice nothing there about Jewish people and synagogues, and especially monotheists who are a part of a religion where the foundation of that religion is what? Oh, the Torah. Oh, yes, the thing that you're supposed to read in the synagogue.
So this is intriguing. So when the New Testament was put together, when these books were gathered, I guess you just had just different groups of Christians believing and practicing in certain, believing certain portions of their particular book. So I guess when you put it all together, it sounds like it's more political than anything. We don't want to, piss off the South Side, so we'll include their book too, or something, because it seems very strange that they keep all those books, because Mark, it's not that exciting compared to
Mark.
The others.
No, I think Mark's the best. It's all a matter of taste, I guess.
Yes, but, I guess so.
I think what happened is originally these different Gospels are written in different communities, but they get copied and they get spread around, and different communities start liking to use more than one Gospel. And
then
it came a point where they, the church leaders had to decide which ones were going to consider authoritative. Because there were other Gospels written, too. I mean, there was a Gospel allegedly by Peter, and one by Thomas, and one by now Judas Iscariot, and, Mary Magdalene. And
now, is he going to mention that these are all 2nd century and beyond? Is he going to point out that none of these come from a 1st century Jewish context, like Matthew, Mark, and Luke do? In fact, there are none others like Matthew, Mark, and Luke in any of these? Or is he just going to throw it out there and let the infidel guy run with it as far as the infidel guy obviously wants to run with it? Well,
which ones are going to be our scriptures? And so they had to make decisions.
Yeah, speaking of which, I remember in the presentation someone asked you about the 12 years of Jesus' missing life. And I can't remember the context, but I thought that actually there is a non-canonical gospel that covers that, isn't it? The infancy gospel of Thomas or something like that?
The infancy gospel of Thomas doesn't cover... what it covers is the years between Jesus being 5 years old and 12 years old. It's a fantastic gospel. I mean, it's really terrific. But it's about... the question that's driving it is if Jesus was a miracle-working son of God as an adult, what was he like as a kid?
right.
And so it has all these terrific stories about Jesus. And part of the interest of the account is that Jesus turns out to be a bit mischievous. And,
which is an understatement, by the way.
Yeah, well, when his playmates get on his nerves, he zaps them, and when his teachers bother him, he just he kills them.
Wow.
By speaking a curse on them.
My gosh.
Yeah.
I guess we can figure out why that one didn't make it to the camp.
Yeah, I think that one didn't have a very good shot.
but if the communities accepted that.
Well, the community, yeah, I mean,
it would have been fine.
As scripture for some communities, absolutely.
Amazing.
Ladies
and gentlemen, if you have any questions, feel free to type those questions in red in the SitCam video room as well as the IRC room. I'm switching back and forth between windows. If I miss it, please just go ahead and try to type again. Again, the 800 line is not working because, unfortunately, there's no line. I moved into another room and I couldn't drag the line all the way across. I'm waiting for someone to install it. So that is why, if you're wondering. All right, so what are some of the... I'd like to give you an opportunity to maybe respond to some of the major criticisms that maybe you're getting about your work, if you don't mind. Already you said, though, they're not really challenging the content. They're actually agreeing with you. Well, yeah, it's in there, but they just kind of say it's irrelevant. So...
I actually haven't read too many criticisms. Nobody's actually criticized me to my face or written me an email pointing out that I've made any mistakes. The book is filled with factual information that scholars know. The one objection I've seen is that people think that some people might be misled by what I say. And if they're misled, it's because they're not reading me very carefully. And so, I mean, I should reiterate what I said before, that most of these hundreds of thousands of differences in our manuscripts don't matter.
Okay.
Most of them just show that scribes in the ancient world couldn't spell any better than my students can today. I mean, they just, they misspell a lot of words, and those are changes. So, that's a majority of the hundreds of thousands of differences in the manuscripts.
Right.
But there are other differences that really make a big difference. I mean, does the Gospel of Luke teach that Jesus' death brings about an atonement for sin?
Okay.
Depends which manuscript you read.
Hmm.
Probably in the original text of Luke, there are some manuscripts that have an atoning a doctrine of the atonement and some that don't have the doctrine of atonement. That seems to be important to me.
Now, let me just explain really quickly, and we'll take time to deal with it another time, but he's talking about a single variant in the Lord's Supper account where either it says, "This is my body broken for you," or whether it doesn't say, "for you." That's the entire variant. And so from Ehrman's perspective, this is one of my criticisms. If you want some more criticisms, Ehrman's reading of Scripture is really bad. It amazes me sometimes how he reads particular texts. If he wants a factual error, here's a factual error. In his 1993 work, The Orthodox Corruption of Scripture, he attempts to argue that Luke is very inconsistent with himself in the description of when and how Jesus is declared to be Lord and Christ. He tries to create this idea that Luke presents all sorts of differences. The way he reads the text in the process is amazing to me. Truly is. I sit there and go, how did you get that out of that text? But one of the places, he twice in one paragraph refers to Acts 2:38 as a place where Luke said that both in regards to being Lord and Christ, that it was at the crucifixion that Jesus is made Lord. It's at the crucifixion that Jesus made Christ. And he cites Acts 2:38. Look up Acts 2:38. It has nothing to do with it. It's Acts 2:36. And even Acts 2:36 doesn't have anything to do with it, but he's referring to Acts 2:36. But twice he says Acts 2:38, and this is in his scholarly work. 12 years later, he publishes Misquoting Jesus. And guess what happens? He brings those two errors over word for word directly into Misquoting Jesus. So they are repeated in that text. Evidently, in 12 years, hasn't revisited whether that actually is what's going on there or not. And so when we go to this text in Luke, there's all sorts of things in Luke. Remember, Luke is writing in a community. We know what the community believed. Luke is traveling with Paul. This idea that we can take Luke and separate him out and go, well, if you don't have him specifically stating a doctrine of atonement like everybody else has to keep repeating the same basic things over and over again, or it's not there. That completely ignores the fact that he's writing to a community. He's writing to Theophilus, who already knows these things. And so to say that one variant of the word you determines whether there is or is not a doctrine of atonement in Luke is simply absurd. But he gets away with it all the time. Gets away with it all the time. And yes, it's very frustrating for me to listen to his New Testament introduction class and to know there are people listening to this, and this is all they are ever going to hear. And they will never give a second thought to the gospel as a result. Yeah, that's frustrating to listen to. But it's even more frustrating to recognize the vast majority of believing Christians don't have a clue how to respond to the man. And as he himself keeps saying, there's nothing new in my book. And on a lot of grounds, that's true. I mean, it is absolutely shocking to me that so many people, so many Christians, know so little about the background of their Bible. And I am one person, I think, who can, with some level of integrity, say, I've been trying to tell you so. I mean, I take a lot of heat for emphasizing so often the textual issues regarding the New Testament. And not just the King James only, folks. I mean, that's if I leave that to the side. I have often said to Christians for a long time now, we need to know where the Bible came from. You can't ignore those little notes down at the bottom of the page. And I've written books on the subject. And how long ago was it that I had Brother Kirshner on? And we spent an entire hour on one textual variant. One textual variant. And a lot of people would say, man, that is not exciting webcasting. You want to make your ministry big, you can't do that kind of thing. Well, there's a reason why we do this kind of thing. And now you're seeing it. It amazes me. There's so many people going, why, John 7:53 through 8:11, the story of the woman caught in adultery isn't in the earliest manuscripts? I didn't know. Mark 16:9, wow, I didn't know that. I mean, these are basic things. This is textual criticism 101. This is part of introductory stuff. But in the vast majority of evangelical churches, it's not even a part of that. We don't want to talk about it. We just want to keep people feeling good and warm and entertain them real good. Send them out totally unarmed into a world filled with people who've been listening to Bart Ehrman. Yeah, that's showing a whole lot of pastoral care for their souls, huh? We live in an anti-Christian society. If you haven't figured that out yet, then you just don't get out much. So we have got to be prepared to give an answer for these things. It's just necessary. It's got to be done. And the stuff he's pointing out, there's answers. Now, I'm not saying every person has to do what I did. I posted a blog article yesterday digging into Ehrman's assertion that the majority of manuscripts known to Origen had chorus rather than charity at Hebrews 2:9. I dug into it and discovered that the Greek underlying the English translation of Origen's commentary in John does not lead us to believe that he was saying a majority of anything. Okay, I recognize that I do have resources a lot of people don't have at that point. But to at least understand the background of the Bible, to at least understand where the manuscripts are coming from and have some basic knowledge of the major variants, I mean, the two largest variants, John 7:53 through 8:11, Mark 16:9-20, we just got to know those are there and be able to give an answer for people who throw that out as if, wow, this is, you know, that really makes me wonder. It shouldn't. The only reason this kind of argumentation is effective is if we, in the context of faith, in the church, have not built the proper foundations for our people. And the churches that don't do that are going to be the churches that have to continue to minimize what it is that they are saying and teaching and proclaiming is true. So if you want to continue to preach the whole counsel of God, well, there's some work we need to be doing. Well, I didn't get into where the infidel guy and Ehrman start arguing, but we've got next week yet. And then we go silent. We'll try to do some blogging, or some obviously blogging, but also some dividing lines over Skype while I'm gone. I'll try to give a report if I possibly can. In fact, Michael Fallon said they did a Skype broadcast from sea, and it sounded great. So we'll see if we can work out to fill you in. But keep praying about the debate coming up. See you next week on The Dividing Line. God bless.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracts. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.